Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome to Most Notorious. I'm Eric Rivenis. So I get some great ideas for episode subjects from my wonderful listeners. One such listener, Mary Virginia, recommended I contact the author we're about to hear today. So thank you so much for that. My guest today is Catherine Spoody, a former historical archaeologist for the National Park Service in Western America. She's written many books about archaeology and the history of the West, and also written for multiple publications and journals. She's here today to discuss her book, That Fiend in Hell, Soapy Smith in Legend. Thanks so much for your time.
This is going to be fun. Thank you.
When did you first become interested in Soapy Smith?
Well, I worked for the National Park Service for my entire career as an archaeologist. And one of my jobs that came up was to go up to Skagway, Alaska in the late 1970s to help the National Park Service plan how they were going to do building rehabilitations in that town as part of a commemoration of the Klondike Gold Rush. Part of the process the National Park Service has to go through is making sure that no significant archaeological remains are going to be disturbed by any ground-disturbing activities. And so that was my small portion of a much larger project there. As I usually do when I go off to a place that I don't know much about, is I began to read everything I could about the history of the Klondike Gold Rush and about the history of Skagway. So I imagine the first time I encountered Soapy was probably in the very first history book I picked up about the Klondike Gold Rush, because his story, the legend of what he did in Skagway, is part and parcel of the Klondike Gold Rush and is one of those dramatic events that everybody, especially in the popular press, wants to talk about when they talk about the history of Alaska, the history of the Klondike Gold Rush, and the history of Skagway in particular. So it was probably about 1979, 1978 when I first ran into Soapy Smith.
Soapy Smith is a pretty iconic character in Western American history, but I have a lot of listeners from around the world who may not have heard his name before. Where has his character appeared in literature, television, and film?
Well, Soapy's legend first appeared in books, and they appeared in popular books during the 1930s through the 1960s, during a time in which the Wild West, the story of the Wild West, was very popular in popular culture. People who were writing about him were often journalists who enjoyed writing a story in the method of a novel, or like a narrative sort of thing, in which dialogue could be invented and a story made very personal. And so the earliest and probably most widespread distribution of his story came during the time when the Wild West was showing up on television and all that sort of thing. I do have a list of some of his films, but if you carefully look at this list, you'll find that his story is usually a kind of a minor accompaniment or embellishment on a greater story of the Klondike Gold Rush, because he's an interesting character and he adds a lot of character and color to the story. As far as I can tell, the only film that ever really focused directly on his story was a 1941 film called Honky Tonk, which starred Clark Gable. But because there was disagreements between MGM, who was making the film, and the descendants of Soapy Smith about how the story would be told, MGM finally decided to change the names of all the characters and tell it the way they wanted to tell it. Since that time, as far as I can tell, the Soapy Smith legend has been an accompaniment to the larger story of the Klondike Gold Rush.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the series in the early 2000s, HBO's Deadwood, had a character loosely based on Soapy Smith named the Huckster. Is that correct?
Well, yes, you could say that. I would say that that particular character is actually based on that whole group of people at that time who were doing the same thing that Soapy was doing. So any specific, like in Deadwood, there may well have been a huckster, and it's just because Soapy has become probably the best known of the hucksters from that time period. He has taken on the persona of the huckster. So when you have a character showing up in a movie that behaves in the same way Soapy did, there's a tendency for devotees of that genre to say it was based on Soapy's life. Soapy's life is based on the lives of every other huckster that was going on at the same time. So he certainly wasn't the only one out there.
Sure, that makes sense. So I'd like to start by going way back to his childhood and formative years, long before he became known as Soapy. Where did he grow up and what were his early days like?
Soapy Smith was born in Georgia, Cowichan, Georgia, which is near, it's about 75 miles away from Atlanta, Georgia. He was born in 1860, right before the start of the Civil War. His parents were plantation owners. He was well-educated, as was anybody in that area that had the relative wealth that they had. His father was a lawyer, and his mother was a genteel Southern belle lady. Soapy was 6 months old when the Civil War began. By 1864, when Sherman pushed the Northern Army through to Atlanta and burned Atlanta, a great deal of damage was done to every place in the countryside for 100 miles around, including Soapy's parents' plantation. A year later, in 1865, the Civil War ends, the South concedes defeat, and the North begins to enforce laws organized towards reforming the way the South did business. Most of those reforms, of course, were focused on the institution of slavery, although there were a number of other political issues involved, largely that of states' rights and that sort of thing. In the process of what became known as Reconstruction, Soapy's parents lost their ability to make a livelihood in Georgia. They had 57 slaves in 1860. Those slaves were all liberated. The source of the wealth of plantation owners in the 1860s was the number of slaves that they had working for them. So immediately his father lost an ability to make a living through the farming of cotton like he had been doing. And furthermore, Reconstruction limited the amount of the law practices that could be done by lawyers in the South. As a result, Sophie's father was unable to practice law either. So after a number of years of struggling to make a living in Georgia, the family picked up and moved to Texas. They moved to a place called Round Rock, Texas. Round Rock in the 1870s was a very typical cow town. It was at the terminus of a railroad, and the purpose of the railroad was to transport beef from the rangelands of Texas to the eastern and Chicago markets and that sort of thing. As a result, Round Rock was very similar to what the popular culture would begin to identify as how Dodge City, Kansas, for instance, was. It, a wild and woolly town that was mostly devoted to the service of adult males, transient adult males who would come into town, blow off all their money, and then leave. So that the saloons, the gambling dens, the prostitutes became a very important part of the culture of these Western cow towns. So Soapy moves into Round Rock, Texas when he's 16, 17 years old, feels like he needs to make a living to support his brothers and sisters and a father that cannot make any money anymore. The first job that he has is as a salesman in a store. I haven't been able to determine what kind of store it was. I'm imagining it was a general store of some kind. And he became, because of his incredibly charming and gregarious personality, he quickly became the best salesman on the floor. And as he honed his skills, he began to realize that he could sell anything for any price. And of course, it was to people's benefit, or the salesman's benefits in those days, to purchase items for sale at the very cheapest price you possibly can and sell them for the highest possible price you could obtain. So his hustle began when he was in his late teens, making people believe that they were buying bits of jewelry or that sort of thing that had very little value. And in their mind, he convinced them that these were good investments, that they were much more than they appeared to be. And that's how his huckster life began.
So we've been referring to him as Soapy, but he's not yet Soapy at this point, is he?
Actually, it's a little hazy about where Soapy earned the name Soapy. But it certainly was the first time it shows up is in the mid 1880s in Denver, Colorado. But his family believes he was actually learning and picking up the skills of the soap game, even perhaps as early as his life in Round Rock, Texas, because it was a fairly common con in which the huckster, the salesman, would gather a group of people around, start wrapping up plain bars of soap that usually sold for 5 or 10 cents a piece. He would wrap them in pieces of paper. And every once in a while, to get the crowd all excited about what was going on, he would add a layer of a bill, like a $1 bill, a $5 bill. Some reports are he even used $100 bills. I find that a little difficult to believe because $100 in 1870s would be equivalent to $2,500 today. So even putting a $1 bill, which was now the equivalent of over $20, was a powerful incentive to the crowd. He would first wrap the piece of soap with the currency and then cover it over with the same kind of paper that he was wrapping the other bars of soap. He'd mix everything all up. A plant of his out in the crowd would volunteer to come forward and pay 25 cents or a dollar. The amount changed as time went on for that single bar of soap. And lo and behold, the person who was working with Soapy would always pull up the bar of soap with the large denomination bill wrapped around it. Well, after two or three things of that happening, everybody in the crowd was clamoring to buy soap at a dollar a bar, which would be the equivalent of $20 or $25 a bar of soap today. And of course, none of the common people ever got the big bill. But that was what became known as the Soap Gang. And Soapy was perhaps the best practitioner in history of the Soap Gang. And as he moved around the West, he acquired that nomer, Soapy, which he did not like. He didn't like being referred to as a slippery character. But people at the time also realized that that was a beautiful double meaning with his Soap Gang, and he was slimy in terms of his dealings with the public.
What did he prefer to be called? Just Mr. Smith?
Oh, his name was Jefferson Randolph Smith. He went by Jeff Smith, and I doubt that he ever referred to himself as Soapy. His great-grandson, who has written a wonderful book about Soapy's life, is also named Jeff Smith. And so in my mind, I think of Jeff Smith as Soapy's great-grandson, and it's easier for me just to talk about Soapy so that I'm not getting confused with the man who has really written the most in the world about Soapy's life.
So can you talk about his days in Colorado? How did he cut his teeth there?
Yes, he stayed in Round Rock probably for only a year or two, and then his name starts showing up elsewhere in the West. And there's thought that he may have even gone to Denver as early as 1879 or 1880. Certainly by 1880, his name is showing up in, his name and his reputation are starting to be made of, in the mining camps of Colorado. There's a whole folklore about Soapy in Leadville, Colorado, which was experiencing a silver rush at the time. People who really study Soapy can't find very much of that evidence. There's just some little bits and pieces of it, and it's more of the folklore than it is anything in solid fact. Certainly, he was operating and doing his Soap Gang and other types of cons in Denver during the early 1880s. And certainly by the late 1880s, Soapy had acquired enough wealth that he was able to purchase a saloon, began running his operations out of this saloon, and began to gather a following of people who would work with him to either run these cons or to enable him to do cons through their manipulation of local politics in Denver.
So Soapy Smith's mythical status really manifested itself during his time as a citizen in Skagway, Alaska. What was the town of Skagway like in the 1890s? You've already mentioned the gold rush. Is that what brought Soapy Smith to Skagway?
Right. It actually goes back to his activities in Denver. In 1894, the city of Denver finally was able to get a city council and a mayor who were sympathetic to the reformers, the moral reformers in the community. And as a result, a number of laws were passed in Denver that pretty much eliminated the gambling halls and the saloons, or really restricted the amount of activities that could go on in the saloons, and certainly closed down all of the gambling halls. That is how Soapy made his living. So he left Denver and wandered somewhat around the West trying to find a new home, kind of settled in the Pacific Northwest, reports of him in Seattle, reports of him in Tacoma. When the Klondike Gold Rush began in July of 1897, Soapy was poised and looking for a new place where he could get by with his nefarious activities because there was no formally established law and order. So, alas, the Klondike Gold Rush was made to order for Soapy and the type of people that did the same things he did. The Gold Rush began in late July of 1897. He was on a ship to Skagway by early September 1897. And he shows up in town, finds a town in which there is no organized law and order other than the typical kind of policing system that's set up in these boom mining towns. Skagway had not existed in June of 97. It suddenly became a tent city in July of 97. And probably by the time Soapy got there, there were a few slapdash frame buildings starting to be put up, but there were as many as 1,000 to 3,000 people funneling through Skagway on a daily basis. And many of them were kind of starting to get camped there to see what the weather was going to be like as they took the trail to the north. As a result of these people sitting around trying to figure out what they were going to do, they became great targets for any of these hucksters that wanted to divert them by playing a gambling game that was fixed to benefit the person who was running the game rather than to benefit the person who was doing the gambling.
Is he making a living mostly by gambling, or does he have other things going on in town too?
Well, the way Soapy usually tried to operate was once he'd get himself into a community that he felt comfortable staying in, he would make an investment in the purchasing of a saloon so that he'd have a base of operations. Throughout the fall of 97, I believe that Soapy was still trying to decide where it would be best for himself to work out with this. And he actually had the idea that he wanted to go on into the interior of Alaska, set up he wanted to get the monopoly on gambling concessions in Fort Yukon, which is at the mouth of the Yukon River. That was one of the routes that the gold rushers went into. He found out in order for him to do that, he'd have to go to Washington, D.C. and curry favor with some congressmen to get permission to be the only one that had the license to sell booze, to run a gambling hall, and that sort of thing. So he really did not get back to Skagway until January of 1898, because he was busy throughout the fall trying to get a license to run the kind of operation he really wanted to run. He did get that license, but when he got back to Skagway, he suddenly discovered that instead of 1,000 people funneling through Skagway, there were now 8,000 people at a time trying to get to the north. And he immediately began, he found that he could make tons and tons of money with his con games on the streets without having to take the trouble to build a whole new business. Throughout the spring, well, the winter and spring of 1898, Soapy eventually curried the favor of the people who were really in control in Skagway. He was finally able to rent a small building where he could begin to run his saloon. And from what I've discovered, he really did not start that saloon business until May of 1898. Within 6 weeks of him opening his saloon, he was dead. So he really didn't do what legend has said he did in terms of running a saloon and conning every guy that went through town until very late in his stay in Skagway. By that time, he'd been in Skagway for 5 or 6 months, and he only had a month to live.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from 2 Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The storm broke in Chattanooga one night in 1906 when a young woman was the victim of a violent crime. From that moment, the city knew no peace for four furious years. At the center of the storm was the notorious inmate, Dave Edwards, who was awaiting trial on murder charges. After a high-profile case threatened to go cold, the desperate county sheriff did the unthinkable by freeing Dave Edwards from jail and deputizing him to track down the fugitive. Grievous Deeds, 4 Years of Fury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, written by Kimberly Tilley, narrated by Samuel Burst, is the most amazing true crime story you've never heard. Listen to Grievous Deeds, the audiobook, available on Audible, iTunes, and Amazon.
So if you don't mind, let's talk about the last 6 months of Soapy Smith's life in Skagway, Alaska. First, if you could walk us through the historically accepted timeline of his rise to power, from the saloon shootout through the spring and summer of 1898 and to his death. What is the generally accepted history of his last few months alive?
I think that everybody who knows Soapy's story can agree that two men were killed on January 31st, 1898. One of the individuals who was killed was a worker, a common worker, who had gotten drunk and was hassling the owner of a saloon. And the saloons in those days usually had bouncers. They called them heelers at the time, but they were basically what you think of as a bouncer. The bartender, who was kind of in charge of everything, was whatever management happened to be on site at the time. When Andy McGrath, this worker, became drunk one evening and started yelling at the patrons of the bar and bartender, the bartender called in the owner. The owner called for the police, and through a variety of mishaps, the bartender ended up shooting and killing Andy McGrath, and in the process also shot and killed the deputy marshal who had showed up to try to get this all straightened out. The townspeople, of course, weren't very much concerned about Andy McGrath, but they were concerned about their deputy marshal because he had been one of the first people who had come to Skagway. He was a well-known citizen. He was not formally on the rolls as a deputy at the time because the fully established deputy was on his way to the capital of Alaska at that time, which was Sitka, transporting a prisoner. And he had asked James Rowan to take over for him while he was gone. Rowan had very little experience. He did have a little experience as a deputy marshal, but it was more as a sheriff's deputy in the state of Oregon before he came to Alaska. So obviously in a very chaotic, anarchic situation like this, things happen. And in this case, it was a case where two murders occurred on the same night. The townspeople, having no duly official appointed law officers, did what every community does in those circumstances. They called together what they call a safety committee. They had a public meeting. They voted to see what needed to be done to apprehend the criminal and to carry about justice. So that's all pretty well established that it as to what happened. Where legend begins to take over at this point is a number of newspapers, especially the newspapers in Denver, who were following Soapy's career because he had been such a notorious person in Denver, picked up on the idea that somehow Soapy had a lot of power in Skagway. And Soapy himself loved to promote himself. So he did not discourage stories that came out about how he intervened between the vigilance committee, which wasn't really a vigilance committee, but in his mind it was, and the bartender who had inadvertently killed the deputy marshal at the same time he was trying to control his fractious customer, who definitely was displaying a gun and threatening to shoot and kill everybody in the saloon. So over the course of a day or two, the community finally decided that they would they were able to talk the saloon community into turning over the bartender. They were able to get through their formal committee meetings a decision to take him to Sitka. They finally were able to get the U.S. Marshal to come up to Skagway from Sitka. That took a number of 4 or 5 days for that to happen because communications were so poor in those days. And in reality, Ed Fay, who was the bartender that did the shooting, was incarcerated in Sitka. The legend that arose was that Soapy kept the Vigilance Committee from hanging Ed Fay, and that he solely was responsible for saving Ed Fay's life. As a result, Soapy became a hero to a certain segment of the community in Skagway. He was at that time still viewed as a notorious and not law-abiding citizen by another segment of the community. So we have two versions of the story happening even right there. By middle of March of 1898, the Vigilance Committee had finally decided that they were going to try to control all of the gamblers in town. They weren't picking on Soapy in particular, but they issued an edict that all of the con men, the hucksters, the flim-flam men in town had to leave town. And Soapy became irate. This was the source of his wealth at the time. And so he formed a loose group of people of similar mind with him and began to publicize how wrong it was and acted like Soapy really should be the source of law and order in town and not this committee of miners and businessmen who had been, quote, making rules up to that point, unquote. So in both the historic literature and in the legends, Soapy begins to see himself as the king of Skagway. There were a lot of people who disagreed with him at the time, but because Soapy and his descendants and the people that loved his story capitalized on this concept that maybe Soapy was in charge, his legend took off long before he even was killed. Let's see, what happens after that? Soapy gradually gets more and more press, and by the beginning of May, when he's just finally getting his saloon set up, Soapy decides he's going to take over a parade that is being formed to celebrate recent victories of the United States in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. And all over the country, there were a number of parades on the 1st of May that celebrated the war success. And Soapy stuck himself in the process of organizing Skagway's parade. And there's a number of disagreements between me and others who are connoisseurs of Soapy's legend about Soapy's role in that parade. But that's where his legend begins to show Soapy having great influence in the community. Certainly by the 4th of July, which was about a month later, Soapy is inserting himself into all public celebrations, and the legend becomes that Soapy led the 4th of July parade. The 4th of July parades in those days were incredible events. That was the way the community really got together and celebrated. And certainly in the midst of the Spanish-American War, the 4th of July of 1898 was a major celebration all across the country. 4 days after the 4th of July parade, when Soapy's legend has him at the very height of his power, a miner shows up in Skagway coming out of the Yukon with a poke of gold, with almost $3,000 worth of gold in it. And Soapy's men try their typical con game to get that poke of gold away from the miner. When they succeed in doing so, the miner goes to the local safety committee rather than to the deputy marshal that's in town, because by that time, the deputy marshal had been bribed by Soapy and his followers to turn a blind eye in their direction. when appealed to the safety committee, the volunteer police force of Skagway tried to get some public meetings, basically city council meetings together so that they could decide how are they going to handle this situation, try to get the guy's gold back for them. They thought the way to do it was to reason with Soapy. Soapy decided he was not going to reason with anyone. He was more faithful to his followers than he was to the businessmen in town who were trying to protect the reputation of the town. And by the end of the day, I believe it was a Friday, July 8th, 1898, the con took place in the morning. By that evening, there were mass meetings at the end of a wharf, and four members of the committee, the safety committee, were appointed to guard the wharf to keep Soapy and his men from going down there and disrupting the public meeting. Soapy shows up about 9 o'clock at night, shortly before this meeting is to take place. He is armed. One member of the guards, of the four guards, is also armed. What results is a shootout, a classic shootout. Probably not pacing each other off and shooting at each other, but the two weapons were fired at the same time. And a few moments later, both Frank Reed, who is with the vigilantes, is dead. And Soapy is dead, and Frank Reed is dying. So that it was the death of Soapy. And, you know, it's great drama to have him marching up with his gang, demanding to be let into the meeting. And Frank Reed saying, no, you can't go there. We've been placed here. And then violence that ensues.
Absolutely. So part of what you've done in your book is find lots of new evidence on the real circumstances surrounding Soapy Smith. Could you dispel the myths for us? What was he really like, and how were the last few months of his life different than what has gone down in legend?
Well, I think for me, the main difference is that Soapy did not have the amount of power that his legend says that he does in Skagway. He was certainly a leader of the saloon and gambling community, but he was not a leader of the town. In fact, many of his friends were politically active in the city council, but Soapy himself was never able to actually run for city council. He told everyone he wanted to become the mayor, but he was a long way from ever achieving that goal. But the stories that leaked through to Denver via his friends gave him a greater importance than he really had. So, unfortunately, these stories that were leaking through to Denver and sometimes would stall in Seattle and Tacoma on the way as they got there were exacerbated. The telling of the stories were exacerbated by the fact that the ports along the West Coast wanted to monopolize the trade of the Klondike. They wanted to be the ones that provided the outfits for the gold rushers. Everyone who went to the gold rush had to have a year's worth of supply with them before they were allowed to cross into Canada. So the selling of these outfits became a huge financial benefit to those port cities that could get the business to come from them. Skagway was setting itself up as a competitor because it wasn't that expensive to bring goods through to Skagway. Where it got expensive was beyond Skagway. So Skagway was trying to say, hey, you can just get yourself up here and you can buy your outfit once you get to Skagway. Seattle, Tacoma, Victoria, San Francisco, all those places were trying to say, no, buy your stuff here before you go. And it was in the interest of the big newspapers in those cities to tell everybody how lawless and anarchical Skagway was, to convince them that they didn't want to spend any time there and that they should have their goods before they got to Skagway. So there was a lot of economic and political motive for how the stories of lawlessness were being reported in the lower 48.
So as you've mentioned, the Colorado papers were sensationalizing Soapy's actions, even as he moved to Alaska. Is that when he became a villain in the eyes of the public?
Well, I think there were always a number of people who saw Soapy as a villain, as somebody who was lawless and outside the norms of what Americans, many Americans at that time, were beginning to take a much more moralistic view on issues such as gambling, drinking, prostitution, and that sort of thing. This is an era when a lot of moral reforms are being enacted. And so there's a big divide in the community. Those people who believe that everyone should have the right to drink, to gamble, to use prostitutes, and have that be their own choice, were running up against those who believed that an orderly society could only come about through the restrictions of those liberties. So there was a whole segment of the community that always viewed Soapy as a villain. There was also a large segment of the community that viewed Soapy as a hero and as a leader in protecting personal freedoms.
What were some of the sources you used in your research of Soapy Smith?
Well, because like any legend, and my favorite Western legend is that of Wyatt Earp and the OK Corral, any legend that really gets going, gets started, is so embedded in what is viewed as what really happened that it's hard to tell the two things apart. And that's what was happening up in Skagway. To what extent were these reports of Soapy that were coming in through to Denver, to what extent were they being filtered through the lens of whoever was doing the writing? In the case of the Denver newspapers, there was one newspaper, the Rocky Mountain News in particular, that hated Soapy and would write anything terrible they could ever find out about him. Other newspapers, such as the Times, the Denver Times, was very sympathetic with him and would talk about his accomplishments and what a great leader and that sort of thing he was. So there was a lot of controversy out there, and I knew that, and I had to, what I did was I kind of worked my way back through time, found the current sources that I thought were the most realistic, worked and read everything kind of back through time, and found out where the very first reports were coming from, and then read it all over again in chronological order. The newspaper reports, the magazine reports that were starting to come out. I looked at deed records that are in Skagway. I looked at the city records, such as who is purchasing land and who isn't. Well, and then I had to educate myself all about the local politics, which was quite an exercise right there, because so much of politics is being, even today, is reported through the lens of political satire. And when people read newspaper articles that are very were meant as tongue-in-cheek at the time, there's a tendency to believe them literally. And so what I had to do is try to put myself in the place of the reader in 1898 and see what he was filtering through his brain and his knowledge of the local situation to understand that when a newspaper article talks about how Soapy took over the parade, the May 1st parade, they were doing it very tongue-in-cheek instead of it being a factual accounting of Soapy's influence in the community. So in order to get back to your question, I've kind of gone off the subject there a little bit. Basically, I accumulated every report that I could find, both the newspapers, magazines, later books and that sort, and read them in the order that they were written so that I could pinpoint where the stories were coming from and what the motivations were of the people who were writing the stories.
Yeah, that makes sense. So if I were to visit the town of Skagway today, would I see signs of Soapy Smith? How does his legend live on in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Soapy's stories is practically one of the first story that a tourist to Alaska will hear. And today, tourism is huge in Skagway. There are massive cruise ships. So I've been in Skagway lately when there's as many as 5 or 6 cruise ships in the port, each of them have with several thousand people on them. And the story of Soapy's death in particular is great copy. So the way his story is told most is through a local play that's given in the form of a melodrama. And this melodrama celebrates kind of the whole background of the Klondike Gold Rush, but Soapy is given a very large part in that. And the way that story is told is pretty much the way it's been told since the 1920s, when tourism became very, very important to Skagway's economy.
What does your title, That Fiend in Hell, refer to?
Oh, that quote, and I have it in quotes even in the title, what came from the man who killed Soapy, Frank Reed. It took Frank 12 days to die. He was wounded during the battle, and then he eventually died of peritonitis, which is the infection caused by the wounds. And Frank was an interesting character. He was well regarded in the community. He had a little bit of law enforcement, but he was almost a blustery lawman type, and also was actually a town surveyor. He was the one who surveyed out the original lots for the town. He was well regarded in the community, and he was the one who called Soapy that fiend in hell in almost a joyous manner, because he believed that he himself had put Soapy in hell. But he also said that Soapy was a fiend. And the phrase was recorded by the Reverend John Sinclair, who was a Canadian Presbyterian minister who was in Skagway at the time of the death. And Reverend Sinclair had a very guilty conscience. He had not tried to reform Soapy when he first got there in May. He had avoided Soapy. And I think that in fact, Reverend Sinclair spent the rest of his life, which was about another 5 or 6 years, blaming himself for not being the person to stop Soapy's deprecations on the community.
So do you think Frank Reed was aware that he'd killed someone who'd eventually be considered an iconic figure?
It is my opinion that the people of the community made Frank believe that he was the one who had saved Skagway. There is a great deal of controversy even today, well, especially today, but there was controversy at the time as to whether it was really Frank that fired the fatal bullet. But an inquest was held the next day, practically, and it was a 9-hour inquest by a jury that was appointed by the local judge. This coroner's inquest came to the decision after 9 hours of interviews with witnesses, doctors, and that sort of thing, decided that it was officially Frank Reed who killed Soapy, and that he did so as an act of self-defense. In essence, that made it so that there would be no trial of any kind. I think the townspeople were afraid that the other person who might have fired the gun, his name was Jesse Murphy, may be prosecuted for a crime, and they didn't want to see any big trial coming out of all of this. As a result, they focused most of their efforts on arresting and trying Soapy's accomplices in the robbery, because the townspeople believed justice had been done by killing Soapy, and they had a little bit more of their vengeance on 4 or 5 members of Soapy's gang the following December during the trials on the robbery charges.
What were the robbery charges?
Well, it was it had to do with the way they conned J.D. Stewart, who was the miner who came out of the Alaska, the way they conned him out of his poke of gold.
Oh, right,
and,
right. Sure.
The gamblers all said that they won the poke of gold in a straight gambling game. Of course, Stewart said, no, they picked it up, they hauled it away, and they robbed me. I was not gambling at the time. And so, of course, there had to be a trial to figure out who was telling the truth there. And ultimately, the federal courts did decide that Stewart was telling the truth, that he had been robbed, and that the men who had conspired to rob him of his 3,000 it was less than $3,000, but for all practical purposes, it was $3,000 in gold, that they were all sentenced to very long sentences in prison, federal prison, for doing so.
Where can people learn more about you, this book, and your other work?
Oh, well, I have a website, although I think that the author's website that's on Facebook is the thing that's most available to everybody. So if I'm sorry, not on Facebook, I'm at Amazon.com. If people go to Amazon and search for my name, they'll find my author's site and they can learn more about other books that I've written and something about my academic training and that sort of thing that helped me get where I got with this book.
Well, great. Thanks again for your time.
Yes, thank you for the call.
This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.